The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main
they are
start.
Hard.
4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. Great to be here. Thank you all for joining us. Great program today. So let's get rid of the announcements and get on with our program. You can call us and talk to our guest, Dr. Spoudis, 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Be patient and let the phone ring, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. I do hold callers over the break if that's applicable. And I will answer the phone over the break as well. One favor to ask, don't call with 1 minute left on the show. You guys have 90 minutes or possibly longer if we go overtime to call, and then all of a sudden you start calling at 1 minute before the show ends. You can do better than that, okay? So if you want to talk to Dr. Spoudis, 1-866-687-7223. If you would rather use email, it is Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. Do remember we're a copyrighted and trademark program. You do have permission to download our programs and to share them. Please don't do anything commercial, no edits, private YouTube channels, or anything of that nature. And remember, we don't do or allow written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. We do podcasts, and you'll find the RSS URL on our website, both of our newsletters. And if you have any questions about our podcast, don't hesitate to get a hold of me. You can find us in iTunes, Microsoft, Zoom, and a host of other places around the web. And go to our website, which is thespaceshow.com. So after our show today, there is a comprehensive newsletter that is uploaded, and that detailed newsletter has all the details of our guest bios for the week, what the programs are about in the coming week, and it's the only place you'll find a future events section for the Space Show. Plus, when we have to modify our schedule, and that does happen from time to time, you will find those changes first on the website newsletter. You can also, from there, subscribe to our very short email newsletter. It goes out early Monday morning, California time, and has just one or two lines about the week's programs. Guaranteed, it won't clutter up your email box. Everything we do is archived, so you can listen to all of our programs right off of our website or easily download the shows. We have a store on our website. You'll see it up near the top called Space Show Gear. Please do visit it. We have an Amazon portal where if you use it and you can follow the simple instructions and you purchase your Amazon merchandise, books, Kindles, vitamin pills, whatever, through that Space Show portal, Amazon contributes to the Space Show One Giant Leap Foundation, and we thank those of you who are doing that. It's a great way to contribute with just your routine shopping when you do things through Amazon. There's a guest search tool on our website next to the social media buttons. There you can do global searches like you can in Excel, Word, or a PDF document for your favorite keyword or guest. When you pull that information up, you'll get the dates, and then you can search for those show dates on our Space Show search engine, which is down at the bottom of our homepage. So if you have any questions about any of that, don't hesitate to let me know. Do remember we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, and they do promote cooperative solutions for space security. You can get much more information from them by visiting their own website, www.swfound.org. They do sponsor our webinar series, and our next one is Sunday, August 18th, 1 p.m. California time, and it is dealing with the issue of NEOs and what to do about them. More information about that as we get closer to August 18th. Our guest today, and I'm really happy to bring back, I enjoy talking to him, great friend, Dr. Paul Spoudis. Dr. Spoudis is a senior staff scientist at the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston. His research focuses on impact and volcanic processes on the planets and requirements for sustainable human presence on the moon. He was a deputy leader of the science team for Clementine. That was in 1994, the PI of the mini-SAR radar experiment with India's Chandrayaan-1 mission. That was 08 to 09. A team member of the mini-RF radar on NASA's LRO mission, which is 2009 to the present. He was a member of two White House commissions on U.S. space policy. He is the author or the co-author of over 100 scientific papers and six books, including The Once and Future Moon and The Clementine Atlas of the Moon. He has a terrific website. You can get a lot more information. And also, the material we're talking about today is on this website, www.spoudis, S-P-U-D-I-S, Lunar Resources, that is two R's for those of you that are spelling challenged, .com, www.spoudislunarresources.com. Paul, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm fine, David. How are you?
Fine. So, listeners, for the past couple of months, you'll know that I have been pushing in the archives and on the show. For those of you interested in responding to the NAS human spaceflight study, to send in your two bits worth on why you think human spaceflight is important and what the NAS should consider in those studies. Well, Dr. Spoudis did that, and he contributed. You can see his paper on his website that I just mentioned, Human Spaceflight, Why and How. And I think that's a good jumping off space. Why human spaceflight, Paul, especially in these days and times of economic misery for so many millions of Americans?
Well, it's a good question, and it's something that I think this new study should seriously consider. It's been kicked around sort of in the space community at a very high abstract level for the last few years. We have to kind of step back and look at, well, why do we have a human space program now? And fundamentally, we have one because it's a legacy of a time 50 years ago when we were in a geopolitical contest with the Soviet Union. And it was decided that space was an arena in which the United States could compete with the Soviet Union and likely or possibly prevail. And therefore, the challenge was issued to go to the moon and to do it within a decade. And that, of course, was Kennedy's announcement. And fundamentally, the human spaceflight program that we have today is largely a legacy of that geopolitical struggle. Even after we landed on the moon and that mission was accomplished, there was a lot of program momentum after Apollo to continue both Apollo and to continue human spaceflight. But more than that, we discovered that there actually is great value to human spaceflight in societal terms. It has an inspirational value. It's a technological innovator value. It has value as an educational aspect to inspire students to take up science and mathematics disciplines in school. Those things were all fallout from Apollo. Clearly, Apollo had that effect. And the thought was, well, as long as we have a human space program, then we should do that for those benefits, if no others. And so consequently, we've had the last 40 years or so has been dominated by a series of attempts to recapture that excitement, buzz, that enthusiasm that was generated by Apollo to varying degrees of success. In some cases, it was quite readily picked up, and that good vibe of excitement about exploration came through, and in other cases it didn't. But in broad terms, I think that those of us who grew up in the 60s, and I'm one of them, I was born in 1952, so I was a kid in the 60s during Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, and we had a very different vision of what our future in space would be at the turn of the century, and more, let alone a decade after the turn of the century. And we're not anywhere near that. And in fact, the outlook right now is quite grim. And it's grim because I think we haven't grappled really with the purpose of why we're doing this. You know, what is the real purpose of human spaceflight? Not in practical programmatic terms, but in a broad philosophical sense. Why should we care about it? So what I did in this paper for the National Academy study was to kind of was to address that. And basically, I argue, and in a nutshell, is that people do sort of three broad things. The first thing they do is they explore, discover, and learn. And then that covers not only scientific exploration, but the curiosity-driven exploration, the idea that we want to go to new places, both not only for the scientific knowledge, but also to make discoveries. So, and people do that uniquely. People have the ability to recognize the significant from the trivial and to pick up on subtle differences that a machine might record, but then might be ignored in a return stack of data by the people on the ground operating the machine. People can do this, and I think they have an ability that vastly exceeds that of machine cognition, of recognizing the significant from the trivial. So the second thing they can do, that people can do, is to create, build, and maintain. And this covers the aspect of people assembling and maintaining and repairing large, complex systems in space rather than just abandoning malfunctioning or poorly functioning equipment and launching something completely new from scratch. So this was clearly shown in the shuttle and station programs, where we both service satellites, we repaired the Hubble Space Telescope, we built the International Space Station. The idea was is that we now know that people and machines working together in space can build large distributed systems much more capable and much more powerful than the largest system we could ever hope to launch on a single rocket from the Earth. So that is a unique aspect of human spaceflight that I don't really think has been fully appreciated. Some people appreciate it, but I don't think it's totally sunk into the consciousness yet of a lot of the community. And then the last part of why we undertake human spaceflight is to preserve, protect, and survive. And by that I mean not only to do the things that we would do in space to help protect the Earth, to monitor its systems, to protect it from possible bad effects of asteroid impact, but also to survive as a species. Because ultimately, the story of life on Earth is a story of extinction. And the more reservoirs of human culture you have, the better your chances of survival. So those are sort of the big, broad philosophical reasons. And I lay that out in the first part of the paper. And that was the why. And so then the question becomes how. If you agree that these are valuable things, and they have varying degrees of value, I recognize some are more important than others, but if you agree that in total they all have some value, the question is how can you do this, especially given the serious fiscally constrained conditions that we find ourselves in. And now that delves into the issue of what kind of space program should we pursue. And I kind of divided that into sort of two different categories. One is one where you pursue new firsts and new mega PR stunt missions that accomplish something, that plant a flag, that leave footprints, and you're the first to do this, and you get a lot of media attention for it, but it doesn't lead to anything lasting. And in a way, Apollo was like that. Apollo was about beating the Russians to the moon. Of course, once we beat them to the moon, there was no real reason to continue doing that. If you beat someone in a race, you don't keep beating them again and again. So that's one template. The other template is a gradual and continuous extension of our reach into space using small incremental steps. And that's sort of the path that I've been studying and pursuing, because I think that has the potential to be long-lasting politically. So those are two different mindsets. And I sense a great deal of confusion, especially amongst some people in the space community. They seem to think that you don't need destinations. You can just do technology and the destinations will sort themselves out. And I don't think that's really true. I think a destination focuses your attention on solving a series of problems that are all interrelated and require a solution on a timely basis. If you're just developing technology, you don't do that. You can always put off a problem that doesn't want to come to solution or closure by just saying, well, we'll figure that out later. That's kind of a long-winded answer, but that's what I submitted to the Academy. I don't know what path they're going to take. You can kind of get an idea of where they're going by looking at the questions they pose. To everyone who submitted a white paper, they pose three questions. What are the important benefits provided to the United States by human spaceflight? What are the greatest challenges to sustaining a U.S. government program in human spaceflight? And then finally, what would happen if we abandoned or terminated NASA human spaceflight? Which I thought was an interesting question, because that's one of the things you never ask in public, or at least it hasn't been asked in space policy circles, because you're always afraid the answer might be nothing, and you'll end up with no program at all, which we're very much on the verge of doing.
Well, that shows that they're considering that as an option.
Absolutely. And you know, it's been considered as an option several times. I mean, it was considered as an option right after Apollo 11. When, you know, we'd beaten the Russians, so I'd shut it down, move on. And then it was decided at least twice in the shuttle program after the two accidents. I know it was under consideration in 2003 after the Columbia tragedy, because I actually heard part of that deliberation. So that was certainly an option on the table. And but, you know, the fundamental, at the end of the day, what happens is people realize there is a societal, tangible value to human spaceflight, and that's why it has never been terminated. Because even if they can't articulate it well, there's a sense among politicians that this is a good thing for the country, that there is some good value to it, and they are loath to be the ones to pull the plug on it.
You already have an email question from Jacques in Des Moines, and he says, I consider myself to be part of the new space community, and we seem to think that the only justifiable reason for human spaceflight is space settlement on another world. How does that fit in with what you were talking about, or do you agree or disagree with that?
Well, I know that's what they believe, and that's encompassed in my last thing, is to basically preserve, protect, and survive. That includes settlement. But if you read the paper I wrote on this, the white paper, I also say that's not a justification for a federal civil space program. That may be an ultimate philosophical justification for human movement into space, but the fact is Congress is not going to fork over $20 billion a year so that I can drive a covered wagon to the moon. All right, that doesn't give any benefit to the country, at least no benefit that they can see. But the good news is I don't think you need that as a justification, sole justification. I think you can make the case that the second thing I talked about, basically the ability to assemble and build and maintain things in space, is more than justification enough for practical payback, if that's what you're looking for. And I sense that in most cases that's what the Congress is looking for.
Do you get a response from NAS other than thank you for your submission?
You don't even get that.
Oh, really?
Your paper shows up on their page as downloadable. You fill out a form with your name, your institution, and you have a 100-word summary that you type in, and then they put up a link with the paper that you upload, and that's it.
So your paper is public.
It's public. Yeah, anyone can go to that website. There's about, I looked at it the other day. I didn't count them all, but my guess is there's around 200. White papers that were submitted, and widely variable in quality. Some of them I thought were really quite thoughtful and interesting, and others were just dreadful. But, you know, that's what you'd expect. I mean, you get the good and the bad and the ugly. And it's well worth someone's time, I think, to go to that website. I have that linked on my front page, by the way, of my website, whose URL you gave out. You can go to that and leaf through those papers, and you can get a good feel and see where the space community is at the moment. And it's not really in a good place.
I'm looking at it now. There's quite a few people whose names I recognize, and several of them have been guests on the show before.
Most of the people that I know in the business submitted something, either as the main author or as a secondary author. And I think that's a good thing. I want to make sure. I basically encourage people. I said, look, you may get ignored, but if you don't submit anything, I'll guarantee you'll be ignored.
Absolutely. People, when you – now, it looks like some people submitted two things. Is that right, or more than two things?
Yes. In some cases, they're two copies of the same identical paper. And the only thing I can figure out there is that they didn't realize that when they had first submitted it, it went through, so they tried it again. But in other cases, I think there are a couple of people who submitted A, B, and C, and that was their way of getting around the five-page limit that the Academy asked us to adhere to. I only submitted one. I figured if I can't say what I need to say in five pages, then I might as well just shut up.
And it's closed for comment now, right?
I guess it is. I have not seen any new ones added in the last couple of weeks, so I'm guessing it is closed. However, I would think that if someone has something they really want to say and want to submit, I would just mail it in to them, go to the main website and mail it to them by U.S. mail.
So listeners, you will recognize a lot of the names if you go on there, and then there's just a real short summary for people to see. Have you gotten any feedback from people who have looked at your paper?
Not directly, no. I mean, people who read my blog or who read things that I write for various venues will recognize a lot of these ideas. I mean, I didn't come up with anything new here. I basically tried to summarize what I've been saying in various venues for various purposes over the last decade or so. And so in that sense, yes, people have given me a lot of feedback because I get comments on the blog, I get questions and emails from people, and I have a lot of correspondence that I talk to about this stuff. But I didn't get anything specifically on this white paper.
Interesting. So in terms of, though, you then went to Congress, okay, and so you're now, you get 5 minutes before the esteemed members of Congress, right?
Right.
And you basically, from what I can tell, you answered questions and you advocated why the moon. Is that a correct assessment for Congress?
That's part of it, yes. You know, in a way it's a little misleading to say you just get 5 minutes. What you get is you get the opportunity to submit written testimony. And the written testimony can be, is about five pages or so, single spaced, but you can have attachments to that. So what I did was I wrote up my written testimony was about 5 minutes, five pages. And by the way, that is also on the blog on my website. You can look at that as well. But I also was able to add five attachments, such as the Spudis and Lavoie paper, our architecture, robotic architecture, and some other things, like the CIS lunar ideas. And I added them as appendices and attachments to the testimony. So that becomes part of the congressional record. And in addition to the 5 minutes oral that you get to present to summarize what you wrote, you participate in about a two-hour-long Q&A with the members. They'll ask you specific questions. You get to comment on those. And finally, you get a transcript of the session where you're allowed to edit and amend any comments you might have made. And so it's actually, testifying before Congress is actually an excellent way to get your ideas in front of them. And of course, it doesn't mean that anybody's going to pay any attention to them, but you do get the opportunity to have your say. And I found them very, very receptive. They asked very intelligent questions. They asked specific questions that told me they understood what I was saying. And I was encouraged by that.
Do you get come away with a sense that they're going to act on anything you say, or is it strictly kind of an academic-like exercise?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think that the specific theme of the hearing that I testified at was, what do we need to do to prepare to send people to Mars? Now, that was the broad terms of reference for the hearing. And they sent me like a two-page write-up saying, this was the background, and here's what we want to know, and you're being called to testify in regard to this your area of expertise. And so in effect, they were asked four of us, and we were four witnesses, you know, what is your opinion of the best way to prepare to go to Mars? And, of course, my answer was, the best way to go to Mars is to go to the moon first and learn how to live and work productively on another planet, and that's the experience base you need to go to Mars. And that was sort of, in a nutshell, my answer. But, of course, there are a lot of details in that. My sense was that they sort of knew that was the answer they were looking for. A lot of these are the same people that have supported the vision for space exploration, which was started in 2004, so has been the space policy of this country for almost a decade. So the idea of going to the moon as preparation for doing other things was not a new concept to them. They knew about it. I think what they wanted was information to sharpen their arguments so that when they write the authorization bill, which is what this was in support of, they would be able to state it properly and succinctly and not have any extraneous details.
Do they invite you, or do you get to go and say, I want to come testify, please invite me?
They invite who they want, so they called me. And I guess you can contact them and volunteer to testify. I don't know how successful that is. I haven't done that.
Do they put you up, pay for your transportation?
No, they don't do that.
So all of this is on you, the citizen's shoulders.
That's right.
If you want to do it.
My nickel, and yes, I pay my way there, and they provide me with a bottle of water during my testimony.
Well, we are in a tight budget period.
That's right.
I guess that's...
Hey, it's got the congressional seal on it, so it must be good, huh?
The bottle of water has a congressional seal on it?
I'm just kidding.
Kind of like diapers with the NASA seal on it, right?
Let's not go in that direction.
Did the others who testify, were you all supportive of a similar theme, or were the four of you there to give different perspectives?
I think the latter. I think more of the latter. I was joined by Lou Friedman, who is the former director of the Planetary Society.
Right.
Of course, Lou is a big advocate of the capture an asteroid and haul it back to Earth mission.
Uh-huh.
Steve Squires was a witness, and he's primarily known as a Mars scientist. I think the principal reason he was there at this meeting was by virtue of his role as the chairman of the NASA Advisory Council. So he was representing not just himself, but also the NAC and their viewpoint. And then the last one was Doug Cook, who used to be the AA for exploration after Scott Horowitz left. And Doug used to do lunar and Mars architectures here at JSC. I've known Doug for a long time. So we were the four witnesses. And we all had different perspectives with different emphases. However, I will say that both Doug and Steve and I all agreed that cislunar was the next obvious step for human spaceflight. What we do in cislunar and how long you're there and what your tasks are varied widely among us. But none of us particularly thought the whole asteroid idea was a very good idea. So Lou was kind of by himself in that aspect.
You have another email question. Jody is in Tucson. And Jody says, Paul, can you at all sense if these people are supportive of some sort of constructive, forward-looking human civil spaceflight policy? The reason I'm asking is on the space show all the time, the policy wonks, or the people really in charge of policy, are constantly criticized for how bad a job they are doing, and one just has to look at our space program to understand that it's not being led or served very well. You got a chance to talk to the people who create the policy. Are they micromanaging to excess? What is your assessment here?
Well, I would say that You're right to believe the space program is currently in a state of disarray. I think that the people that I talk to are very concerned about that. You know, look, the people in Congress have a lot to do, and they don't want to run NASA. They don't want to design rockets, and they don't want to build space-faring human exploration architectures. They want us to have a good space program, and they're asking members of the space community, and by that, in this case, I mean us as witnesses, how should they go about doing that? They are very much concerned about the leadership vacuum. I will note that one of the things that really struck me as I listened to the members' statements and the members' questions was how unified it was. I mean, you know, we hear nothing but partisan bickering this and Democrats against Republicans that. They were all concerned about the asteroid mission. They didn't see the point of it. They didn't think it was worthy. They had serious reservations about it. They were concerned about the abandonment of the moon. And remember, I don't think this is any big surprise. The Congress was very supportive of return to the moon on two previous occasions, the two previous authorization bills. There was one in 2005 and there was one in 2008. It was one in 2005, 2008, and in 2010. All three of those basically had the moon as part of the next destination for human spaceflight. So when NASA goes up there and says, we have no plans to do anything on the moon, it would be a step backwards, as Charles Bolden said, they find that very disturbing, because that goes counter to everything they've heard from witnesses, from the space agency, from other policymakers. So they're confused, and they want answers. They want to know what they can do to help fix the situation. And unfortunately, all we could tell them was that, you should say this and you should do that. Whether they actually take that advice or not, I don't know. I will say that when I saw the draft authorization, which came out about a month after I had testified, it came out in mid-June, and it called for basically lunar return, I was very encouraged by that. Now, I was under no illusions. I didn't think that because a draft authorization bill of the Space Subcommittee mentioned going back to the moon that we were home free. I know that there are serious issues with that. But I was encouraged that at least some people on that committee see value in lunar return. So to answer your question, yes, they are concerned about this. I don't think they're trying to micromanage NASA. What they're trying to do is to make sure that we have a capability that survives, because they don't see NASA stepping up to the job of maintaining that capability. That's what concerns them.
And you're saying it did not break on partisan lines. It was pretty united.
It didn't at the meeting I was at. Now, what's interesting is it subsequently, a month later, when the authorization draft was put out, that's when the partisanship erupted. And it erupted, this is interesting, it erupted largely not because of the direction the authorization gave. It erupted because of the budget levels. Effectively, the Democrats wanted to spend $17, $18 billion on NASA, and the Republican House members wanted to spend $16. And they didn't want to spend $16 as punishment, or because they didn't think NASA was unimportant. They were doing this as a result of guidance given to them by the Ways and Means Committee, who was implementing the sequester. So that's where that number came from. It was not a statement of non-support. It was merely this is the rule we got to live with. So at the meeting I was at, I talked to both majority and minority members of the committee, and I had very good discussions with both of them, and they were very supportive of what we were presenting. And it was only later when it came to the actual money you're going to spend that this whole issue of partisanship came up. Now, that has since been conflated and confused. Because the Senate side, you have Bill Nelson on the Senate side, who apparently supports the asteroid mission, and so now he's injected that as a partisan issue. And his claim is because Obama proposed it, the Republicans don't like it. Well, I don't think that's true. I think they don't like it because it's a poor substitute for a productive and useful space program, and I think that's the real concern.
You have a caller on hold. Let's jump to our caller. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you from? Welcome to the show.
This is John in Fort Worth.
Calling from the stockyards, right?
Yeah, me and the cow. I saw about 9 horses this morning on the way out, too.
Cool. we may all be reverting to horsepower like that soon.
Well, all this talk about, I'm hearing, let's go to the moon, let's go to Mars, let's go to an asteroid. We can't even put anybody in orbit right now unless we just do it for the Russians or something. So what I think the real objective should be to get back into orbit, weirdly enough. And it's phase one of a multi-phased objective, which, of course, returns to the moon. And then beyond eventually. And what I think we need to do is, since we really don't have any flying hardware right now, it might be a good idea to actually design something that might be usable, and that would be some kind of a medium to heavy lift vehicle that would put about 50 metric tons, I'm guessing, into orbit that would at least be half reusable, where you could recover the first stage using a technique similar to what Wernher von Braun suggested in his early writings back in the 50s. Except updated for modern technology, of course. which would be to recover the first stage and reuse it, and then use the second stage. It would be a hydrogen oxygen stage that punches on into orbit, which could then theoretically be refueled from a depot and used for missions to the moon.
Paul?
What do you want me to say? I mean, that's great. That's not the direction we're pursuing
right now, I think.
I mean, we all have our fantasy space programs. I can lay out one for you that I think you would probably approve of, and it would be sane, and it would be affordable, and it would give us long-range capability. But we don't have that, and nor are we likely to get it. So the issue is, given the mess that we now have in front of us as a civil space program, is it possible to move forward or not? And I don't know. I go both ways on that. I guess it depends on which way the wind is blowing in a given morning, whether I think it's salvageable or not. I think the intent of the Congress in what they're doing in supporting Orion SLS, that is their attempt to maintain a spaceflight capability. They're not worried about going to ISS because we're going to ISS, all right? Yeah, we're buying seats from the Russians, but it doesn't matter. The Russians are our partners, so what difference does that make? The question is, what are we going to be doing next? Are we going to be doing anything beyond ISS or not? And they're grappling with that. They think that building Orion SLS is the way to ensure the capability to at least provide access to cislunar space for people, and that's what they're pursuing. Maybe it's not doing it the best way. Maybe there are other ways we could do it better. But this is the program we have, and I don't really know any other way around that.
What about the private guys like SpaceX and their Falcon Heavy proposal and things like that? Can't that step in?
It could if it were real, but Falcon Heavy is not flown.
It's not designed yet.
And Falcon 9 has not flown people. So ultimately, though, even if it does, even if Falcon 9 does fly people to and from ISS, that's one step. I mean, the reason we're turning that over to commercial is because it's not something that NASA's perceived that should be wasting money on. So I don't think we should spend a lot of effort creating that capability when it's already agreed that's something NASA doesn't have to do. NASA should be focusing on the hard things, quote, unquote, and the hard things are things with humans beyond LEO. So the question then becomes, what do you want to do with people beyond LEO? You know, is there anything to do with them? And I think there is, and I've stated, laid this out in the things I discussed earlier. But the problem is that we have the situation we have, and we're going to have to live with it. And it's a big mess, I'll grant you that. Some would argue we never should have retired shuttle. We should have kept flying it until we had something, a replacement. That's fine, but we didn't make that decision.
We did retire it, yeah.
So I mean, a lot of these things have been handed to us as a fait accompli, and now we have to decide, can we do anything with what we have?
John?
Well, I mean, I think obviously with what I'm proposing, you do need to have a manned vehicle. And I guess the Orion part of it is, as I say, since that's on the way, why not go ahead and complete that? But the issue is what sort of booster, and I'm worried about the SLS is such as it is now. We're just going to have another incredibly expensive expendable, which is going to be how many missions can we fly with when we could use the money to actually develop a reusable booster. I think that you could recover first stages. When we go back to what happened with Apollo, I mean, I believe that we wanted to get the moon, and we didn't really care about things like sustainability in space, so we didn't design it that way. We wanted to save every ounce we could on the craft, and so that was that. But I think that's a viable. It would be sort of an SL. It would be a launch capability similar to that. But as it is, I think where we're heading to is kind of, well, maybe we'll do one mission or something. But we're not going to. Can we really return to the moon with SLS? We don't have a lander, for one thing.
Well, we could. I mean, you know, one option, it's really interesting the way the moon program was canceled, and the claim of the Augustine Committee was, well, we can't build the crew vehicle and the lander simultaneously. We just don't have the money. So their solution was to go to something called flexible path, where we wouldn't build the lander, but we just poke along developing technology until we had something, and then we'd go wherever we could. Now, the problem is that one option that was never even looked at, although it was pointed out to them, was that the Europeans were actually interested in building the lander. you know, we could certainly have a program in which the United States built the command module and the launch vehicle, and then ESA built the lander. And they were not only interested in that possibility, they were actually eager to take that on. That didn't go anywhere, but the point was is that there were solutions that weren't looked at for a variety of reasons. So, it's fashionable, especially among the new space types, to bash SLS, you know, the Senate launch system and all this. Well, I think that it's a little bit pointless, because SLS may not be a perfect vehicle, and it may not be the vehicle that we wanted or the vehicle we would build in an ideal world, but it will have a lot of capability. And if the argument is, well, we just can't afford to fly it because it's too expensive, well, then effectively that's going to be the end of the space program anyway.
Well, that's what they're doing when they say we're only going to fly it once in 3 years or something.
Yeah, and, well, that remains to be seen, okay? I mean, all that is supposition based on what the projected cost is and how much money they think they'll have. Nobody really knows how much money they'll have, and nobody really knows how expensive the vehicle is going to be. So I think that at some point there will be a realization that we either need to spend what we need to spend to do what we think we should be doing, or then we should just get out of the business. And it may well be that's the second choice is picked. I mean, that's certainly possible. We're well on that road.
Yuck
is right.
John, anything more?
Well, I mean, in lieu of anything better, I would support SLS too, because it's better to at least keep your design teams together and keep as much of the technology together as you can. I think what we have to hope for is that there's something that changes attitudes at some point down the road. And if we lose all capability before that, then it'd be hard to redevelop it. So in that sense, I would support SLS in lieu of what I'm saying. But
so now
is also not such a great time. I mean, it's...
You know, John, what you said about keeping the teams together, I think that, in fact, that was the real motivation for the specificity of the SLS design. It was not, basically, the problem was that when the 2010 authorization was being written, NASA was dragging its feet on the heavy lift vehicle. And as you might recall, after Obama went to KSC and made the speech about going to a near-Earth asteroid and we're going to get rid of this stupid moon program, and then he said, as part of that policy, we're going to evaluate what kind of heavy lift vehicle we need, and then we'll make a decision on it. And every time subsequently that the agency was asked, well, where are you in this process? What have you decided? What are you going to pursue? All they got was blither in response. And I think the reason the Congress wrote in the specs of SLS in the authorization the way they did, and if you look at what they said, it's actually quite interesting. I think that they were trying to preserve the team, and by the team, I mean effectively the knowledgeable technical people who operated Shuttle, who operated the STS system, keep them together so that they wouldn't be dissipated and lost forever. And so they said, well, all right, we're not rocket engineers, but we do know that the Saturn V was a pretty good heavy lift vehicle and had a capability to go to the moon, so let's just build a Saturn V class vehicle. And what they did was to say, we're going to specify a shuttle-derived system that does initially 70 tons, but ultimately 130 tons. And I think that was their attempt to rebuild Saturn V. Because if you read the authorization, they say tons. They don't specify metric tons. And I'm assuming they meant plain old 2,000-pound English tons. And 130 English tons is what Saturn V did. So effectively, they specified building a heavy lift vehicle that was patterned after Saturn V, not because they wanted Saturn V, but because they wanted that engineering and industrial infrastructure preserved. And I think that's the reason SLS came out the way it did.
Yeah. And that's the reason why I sometimes get accused of being a big SLS advocate, because I do too. I actually believe anybody will do what I'm advocating in the near term either. I mean, but I just always like to advocate it from time to time.
Well, I do too, and you know I've got my architecture, and you probably have yours, and we have our little fantasy space programs. What I think we can hope to do is to point out that there are certain choices that can be made that are more flexible and offer more capability than other choices, and that's what I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to say you got to do it my way or you forget the whole thing. I'm saying there are certain decisions you can make that will, in the long term, give you more options than what you have now. And I think that's the best we can hope
for. Well, let me be the devil's advocate, because if you take a lot of the new space position here and you say kill SLS and let's get commercial crew going faster and better, so then you can take these capabilities in the private sector and start to make things happen even beyond LEO, because you've put more money into it on the government side and expedited it theoretically. So we really don't need to be spinning our wheels with an SLS. What we need to do is being encouraging and supporting and expediting the private sector takeover of space transportation.
Well,
now I know it's not real. I know, you know, that Falcon 9 is not yet operational. Falcon Heavy is not yet a real flying rocket. The idea is that they're going to get there, and that if they had SLS money to expedite them, assuming that happened, they would get there a lot quicker, and the benefits would show for us.
They've been showered with a lot of money, and various new space companies have gotten a lot of NASA and DOD money. And they continue to have press conferences and release great graphics and artist conceptions of super rockets and missions to Mars, but building and delivering actual hardware seems to lag that substantially. So anyway, I have a philosophical objection to this. If these guys are commercial as they claim, then why should they get a government subsidy? Right? I mean, this is the same thing. Right now government's running GM. They're running these various the solar companies. They're subsidizing them. Why should we subsidize a commercial space capability? If these guys want to offer a service or sell launch products, fine. I'm perfectly happy to buy from them. Show me your product and show me your service, and then maybe I'll buy it.
Okay, John, are you still with us?
Yes.
Do you have any comments or anything else you'd like to add?
Well, my general thought is that, at least in terms of SpaceX, they already have a commercial cargo COTS program, which should allow them over time to get the number of launches in to verify the Falcon 9 and develop a reliable vehicle, and eventually they should be able to develop a crew capsule out of it. In fact, I kind of find it strange that they want to go into Falcon Heavy rather than just going ahead themselves developing a crew capsule and being the first commercial company to put a person in space, and then maybe they can compete with the Russians.
Well, you know something, John? Well, I'll tell you what I find funny is how come SpaceX has not launched any commercial payload yet?
Yeah.
If Falcon 9 is an operational vehicle and it's as cheap as they say it is, then the people should be beating down their door to launch their satellite. And yet, they haven't launched an ounce of commercial payload.
Probably insurability at this point.
Well, they do have them on the manifest as booked.
Well, they've had manifests for years. I mean, they put out a manifest all the time. It doesn't mean anything. They haven't done it. Anyway,
I think it's probably the insurance issue that nobody wants to risk a $1 billion satellite on a rocket that's only flown very few times.
It might be part of it, but I don't know the answer to that.
But by the time they get through commercial cargo contracts that are already foreseen, they will have had a fairly good launch record, if it works out, that is. They would be able to have enough launches under their belt then to potentially be credible for that purpose.
Well, then that would be great.
And that's why we just have to wait. I think that's a developing issue. I mean, I want to emphasize the new space folks. I'm not totally dissing them. I just don't think they're the answer to everything.
Yeah, I agree with that statement.
Anything else, John?
I guess that's it.
Thank you for calling.
Okay.
Listeners, we're going to head for our break because, believe it or not, we're halfway through the program, and we're going to take 3 minutes off, but you can call us anyway, 1-866-687-7223, and we'll be back with Dr. Spudas and much, much more to come in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Sunday show. And our guest today, Dr. Paul Spudas. And Paul, Dave Ketchlich is on the phone with us. And Dave, welcome. You want to go for your questions real quickly?
Sure. Dr. Spudas, I wanted to thank you first. You did some articles in Scientific American several years ago, and I absolutely enjoyed your writing and your work. And I always wanted, if we ever bumped into each other, I wanted to say thank you for an excellent laying out the potential that the moon offers.
I absolutely
agree with you that going back to the moon is a great place to cut our teeth and gain firsthand knowledge while still in the neighborhood before pushing on to Mars. My question I have is, when you went to Congress, did any of the lawmakers bring up a comment something like this? Is there any discussion of a universal lander that would be useful first at the moon and later be useful with some modification for Mars? And is NASA thinking about system architecture in both realms?
That was not specifically brought up, but it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I had a recent column on my blog and my website, and it was about the role of lunar in-situ resource utilization, ISRU, which is basically using space resources, mm-hmm. in the Mars architecture. And one of my points was that because we now know that the poles of the moon contain not only water ice, which is apparently deposited there by comets, it also has other cometary volatiles there, including carbon dioxide and methane. And the point I was trying to make was that one of the reasons that ISRU is resisted in architectures is because we don't have any real-world experience with it. I mean, we have a lot of lab experimentation, there's a lot of theory, but we've never done it in space. And so I pointed out that you could actually develop and test out the Mars lander on the moon, because we can extract methane and carbon dioxide from the lunar volatiles at the pole and basically create a rehearsal of the Mars ISRU scheme on the moon. So in that case, what you would do is you would develop a lander that you would ultimately want to use for Mars landings, but you would use it on the moon first to basically document that you could develop a reusable, refuelable lander based around LOX methane by going to and from the moon, from, say, the L point and the lunar surface. It turns out that the delta V from the L1 point to the poles of the moon is about 2.5 kilometers per second. It's 3 kilometers per second from low Martian orbit to the Martian surface. So, in fact, it's completely analogous in almost every respect. So to answer your question specifically, no lawmaker asked me that question about commonality of lander design, but it is something that I have been thinking about, and also people who work on lunar and Martian architectures have thought about that as well. So that is in the mix.
Good. That answers my question in regards to the in situ resource development. All you would have to take to the moon is a quantity, you know, several thousand gallons of liquid hydrogen, and then take the CO2 that you have as an ice, or boil it out of the rock itself, and you're making methane and water and liquid oxygen.
You wouldn't even have to import the hydrogen, because the moon... lunar poles have hydrogen as well. They have both. They have it in water form and as hydroxyl. So you could actually, plus we have methane as well. So the point was, you could extract the materials you need to run the Martian system on the moon to prove it out and to validate it technically.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate
it. Penny in Austin, Texas, not too far from you, says, I take it, given your comments on the asteroid mission, that not only are you not that supportive of humans going to an asteroid, but the asteroid capture mission to put it around in orbit of our moon. Why are you not supportive of these missions as an intermediate step to continue an incremental development of our human spaceflight capability?
Primarily because it's not an incremental step. It's more of a dead end. This actually gets back to the philosophical point we were describing earlier. What kind of a program do you want? Do you want a series of PR stunt missions that get splashy headlines and accomplish space first? Or do you want a gradual, incremental, steady increase in our range of operations? And I prefer the latter. I don't prefer the former. I think the haul the asteroid mission back is particularly a variety of the former. It doesn't accomplish anything specifically. You don't get any real product from it. Anything you learn about the asteroid, we already know. You might get some samples of an asteroid, but we already have 45,000 samples of meteorites on the Earth. All the known asteroids are basically varieties of meteorite types that we have on the Earth collection already. You're not going to learn anything about asteroid deflection, because if you rendezvous with a rock small enough to bag up and then drag back to lunar orbit, that's not the way we would deflect an Earth killer asteroid anyway. So the technology you need to capture bag an asteroid and bring it back to lunar orbit doesn't tell you anything about asteroid deflection or planetary defense. So you don't get any scientific value from it. You don't get any operational value from it. You don't have enough time in vicinity of the thing on the asteroid rendezvous with Orion to experiment with resource extraction. You don't have enough power produced by the Orion to do resource extraction. You don't have the equipment or the laboratory facilities to do resource extraction. All you can do is open the bag up, chip off a few samples, and bring it home. And so what you have after the end of this mission is basically a box full of meteorites, for which we already have a bunch in the Earth collection. So I just don't see any value to it. I don't see it as an incremental building block. I see it as a stunt mission that doesn't really accomplish anything.
Okay, so Penny, if you have anything more you want to ask about that, please pick up the phone and call.
Let me make one additional brief comment, because she said I am opposed to human missions to asteroids, and that's not true. That might have value at some point down the road, but it's certainly not something that I think gives you any long-term lasting spacefaring capability. I basically want to create a system that allows us to go anywhere we want, whenever we want. And it may well be that sometime in the future we want to send people to an asteroid, and for a variety of reasons. So I'm not against that in principle. I just don't think it is the logical next step for our Beyond LEO space program.
You have another caller wanting in. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is Marshall.
Go ahead, Marshall.
One of the issues I have
been following is basically the James Webb Telescope and its funding overrun and so on like that. One of the chief fears I have is if James Webb turns out to be a dog of a project, it might just shut down NASA. What is the status of James Webb, and do you really think that it's going to be a launch and actually be the great universal telescope that everybody hopes for?
Well, first, let me preface my remarks by saying I'm not an astronomer, so anything I say about James Webb will probably be construed as being sour grapes or ill-informed. I will say that as a project, it seems to be appallingly managed and operated. In fact, you're right to be concerned about it. There was an article in this week's Aviation Week, in fact, saying that Webb still has serious problems. It's not at all clear that the increase in funding it's gotten over the last couple of years is adequate. They may be back asking for more. It's already had a negative effect on my business. The planetary exploration side of NASA has taken several hits, largely because of the need to support Webb. And of course, we've got the big question with Webb is will it work? I mean, it's a very complicated deployment sequence. It's going to be deployed at Sun-Earth L2, which is a place we can't get to with any human vehicle currently operating. So if the thing is launched and it goes out there and it doesn't deploy properly, or the sun shield doesn't deploy properly and the thing becomes a useless piece of space junk, unlike Hubble, it will remain a useless piece of space junk. So it's one can say that in many ways it's a poorly conceived and executed project. I think that NASA's committed to it. It's clear they're going to spend what they need to spend to get the thing launched. What I worry about is after all the money is spent on it and it gets launched, it's totally out of our hands. So whether it actually ends up working or not and being the premier scientific instrument and successor to Hubble, I think is a big open question. And that's basically, I've just given you everything I know about James Webb. I know that it's in serious trouble.
Yeah, well, as I said, if James Webb gives NASA a black eye, and, you know, I guess it'd be 2019, you know, it might just crash NASA, and then we are really in a problem.
Yeah, well, there are other things that may be in line ahead of it to destroy NASA before Webb gets to it. So we'll just have to wait and see on that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marshall. Listeners, again, the line is 1-866-687-7223. If you were a betting guy, Paul, and you went to Las Vegas, what would you say the odds are that we'll do the Lasso and asteroid mission?
I don't think I would bet a lot of money on that proposition. There are a lot of questions in regard to that, not only about its technical feasibility, but as to its real value. And I think the concern that I heard expressed at the congressional hearing about that mission, I think mirrors the concern I've heard from other people who are not in Congress, who have been in the space business and who see this as a highly questionable concept. So I don't think it's very likely. I certainly don't believe that it'll ever be performed for anything like the numbers that they're quoting. They're basically the Keck study, which is what this was based on, came up with a cost roll up of $2.5 billion. I think that was in their report, and I don't believe that for a minute.
No, I don't either. You may not want to answer this question, but Beth is in Reno, Nevada, and she says, Paul, you've mentioned several times the terrible state of disarray for our civil space program. Given that you are experienced with both NASA and Congress, are you able to put more of the responsibility for the mess-up on one entity or the other, Congress or NASA, or are they roughly equal to blame?
The answer is yes, I am able to, and I will not.
So you don't want to take a position publicly on that?
No.
So there's nothing we can do to twist your arm for that?
Well, anyone who reads my stuff knows where I'm coming from.
Beth, go to his website, SPUTUSlunarresources.com and start reading, and you will be able to figure it out without a lot of trouble. Paul doesn't hide his thoughts or emotions or his perspectives. There's no doubt about that. What is the job? I mean, you know, I get a lot of callers, and they criticize Charlie Bolden, and they hate Mike Griffin. Okay, so for different reasons, you know, they're criticized equally. You know, but as I said, for different reasons. Is it fair to criticize the NASA administrator because they really do serve as a political appointee to carry out the president's mission on space? So if you don't like what the administrator is doing, isn't that a reflection of the White House leadership on space?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. They do serve at the pleasure of the president, and presumably they're carrying out administration policy. Now, that said, you do have the right to hold them responsible for agency performance because they are the NASA administrator. So if NASA has not delivered what they said they would deliver on the schedule they've promised for the cost they said it would cost, then the administrator is the guy who, that's where the buck stops, because he was responsible for that. Now, as far as I don't know the current administrator, I've never met him. I've read a lot of his comments that I see quoted in the press, assuming that they're quoted accurately. I find highly questionable. He's made statements that I take serious issue with, and some that are just plain wrong. So I have serious reservations about him, but I don't know him personally, and it's nothing personal. It's just what I see from him as the NASA administrator. Now, Mike Griffin, I've known for a long time. He's an old friend of mine. He and I have differences on certain topics, but I think he sincerely tried to implement the vision as he understood it and as it was given to him. Now, he made choices that I don't agree with, and we could debate, but they were technically sound choices. Mike is a very good engineer. He knows his stuff. He's very sharp. So you can argue with him about things and debate with him, and he loves to debate. He loves to argue, but he chose he made the architectural decisions he did for very good reason. So it was not done capriciously, and it was not done to annoy people. It was done because he thought, in his considered judgment, this was the way to go. So they're different administrators have different styles. Some are not technical at all. Sean O'Keefe was a guy who came from the Navy and wasn't really a spaceflight guy. Was primarily known as a manager, as a bean counter. In fact, that's what he called himself. But I thought he was a visionary, sharp, and very enjoyable guy to work with. I had a lot of respect for Sean. And it was largely his doing that we got the vision in the first place. He was pushing on it from the inside, and we wouldn't have had that at all if he hadn't made that effort. So different administrators bring their backgrounds, they bring their capabilities, and they bring their prejudices and biases with them, and that's just life. That's the way it is.
Another caller is on hold. Hi, caller. Who are you, please? Hello.
Yes, this is Doug from Southern California.
Okay.
Hi, Dr. Spudis. I know about this. I've read the Spudis Livelle document and plan, the paper. Earlier in this program, you made an interesting statement. You said, you know, we all have our fantasy concepts, and you know, I'm not expecting it to be, you know, mine to be implemented. Were you referring to this Spudis Livelle plan? My question is, to what extent was the plan that you guys published simply to prove a point that it's technically possible to go to the moon, unlike what the Augustine Commission said, under the current budget? Or to what extent is it a serious proposal for a new direction for America's space program?
Well, it's both. And when I say I don't expect them to implement my specific program, what I mean by that is there are a lot of architectural details that could probably be improved or changed. But I certainly published that paper with the serious intent of showing that there was an affordable path to the moon available. And that was the important point. It wasn't so much yes, you must fly all these things on an Atlas 551. Yes, we must have this specific mission at this specific time. What we tried to show was that there was an approach to returning to the moon that made sense fiscally, technically, and in terms of your long-range goal. So that's what I meant by that. I didn't mean to say that I was just doing this for a laugh. I was serious. I do think that this is the way to go back to the moon. But on the other hand, I fully recognize that certainly Tony and I are not omniscient. We probably screwed up some stuff, and we didn't figure out all the details correctly. So it would likely be changed at some point and modified to the extent that it needed to be.
Then my next question would be, you know, so what realistically, because my sense is the plan that you guys laid out was a major plan, you know, $87 million, and that would, I think, would necessitate, just by its nature, necessitate a pretty significant reworking of our current program, or even the previous program, Constellation, for that matter. So I guess I'm wondering, how do you expect it to go from here? How does something like that become policy?
Well, what might happen is that someone would see the logical value of this, the sense of it, and say, okay, well, what we really need to do is to develop a way to go back to the moon that uses small incremental steps that allow us to give us certain capabilities at certain levels, and then operate those small pieces as one big distributed system. That's the big idea in the paper. Now, whether it actually costs $88 billion, or whether it takes 16 years, like we said, or whether it takes 20 years and takes $100 billion, or even if it takes 30 years and it takes half that amount of money, I think is less important than the idea that, one, you know where you're going and what you're trying to do, and two, you've actually mapped out an incremental plan to do it that ultimately gives you that cumulatively works as one big capability. That was the main philosophical point we were trying to drive home.
Okay, I see. I know that initially you had indicated that you got some positive response from some people within NASA to your guys' paper. Can you give any updates? Is there any more discussion or any committees that are looking at using those principles, those concepts, to propose a different architecture?
No, that kind of, it's kind of in stasis at the moment. I've presented it to a bunch of people, some at the center, some at headquarters. I got good feedback from that, but remember, they're like David said, they're constrained by what they're told to do by the people they work for, and
right.
We're not going to the moon. That edict has been issued, and therefore it's not being looked at in any serious detail. But it's not going anywhere. There's nothing in there that has an expiration date on it. So if at
right.
some point someone decides that, hey, that going to the moon actually did make sense, it can always be dusted off and used again.
Right. Okay, great. I appreciate your comments.
Thank you for the question.
Appreciate your work, too.
Thank you, Doug. And listeners, that opens up again, 1-866-687-7223. Email, of course, drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. If you could prioritize in importance all of what you write and you talk about and you blog about and develop it into an action plan, you know, the Paul Spuda's business plan for getting out of our space mess and moving forward, what would be the first thing on the list that you would like to see done?
Well, that's an interesting question. I guess it depends on whether you think the task before us is primarily a problem of resources or a problem of approach.
Well, it's
and
your
I'm
plan.
I'm inclined to think it's more the latter than the former. People like to sit around and complain, oh, NASA doesn't have enough money, and they should be given twice what they should be given 1% of the budget instead of less than half, which is what they get. And I guess my attitude is, well, they shouldn't be given that amount of money unless they come up with a plan that shows they know what they're doing and they know what they're trying to do. So the first thing I would do is to lay out a systematic plan to increase our operational reach in space. And that has several different pieces. It has and one piece might be to build to do utilization experiments aboard ISS, for one thing. For example, you could practice cryogenic liquid handling and transfer in microgravity on ISS. You could basically have a pallet that did experiments dealing with industrial processes in space, things we might do when we start building permanent infrastructure in space. You might build a cislunar station, a cislunar habitat module and docking port, and send it to GEO or to one of the L points, L1 above the moon, and then use that as sort of the first destination for Orion when it finally becomes operational, when it finally flies. I would plan a series of robotic missions to the poles of the moon to both prospect for water ice, to document how much is there, and to do some initial experiments in cracking that water and making useful product out of it. All that can be done robotically. You don't have to send people first. You want to send robots to the moon first to basically start laying the groundwork for ultimately building the outpost and for people to come later. And so there are a lot of different things you could do, and all of them are not determinate. All right, if I do all this stuff, I'm not saying, okay, I am going to go build a base on the moon. What I'm doing is I'm laying in the strategic knowledge, infrastructure, and the physical infrastructure I will need to go beyond LEO, whatever I do, whether it's asteroid hauling or whether it's going to Phobos and Deimos or whether it's a Mars mission itself. You begin to lay in that groundwork. And we're going to need that in any event, so why not get started on it? So that would be sort of the first thing I would look at.
Would you ever think about a new SPUTIS paper on your business plan for getting us out of this mess step by step?
If I thought that it would have some impact and some value, yeah, I would think about it. I don't know what I would say differently or new than what I've been saying. I mean, I know it's kind of scattered around in places.
Well, it'd be more about the organization and how you structured it and how you put it in a priority sense and why. You're basically making a golden book of really complex theories and ideas and methodologies for people who need a lot of help in moving us forward.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. Yeah, that might be actually worth doing, and I'll give that some thought. I think that I've talked for a long time about how one of the biggest problems we have with our civil space program is we don't know why we're doing what we're doing. You know, we don't have a good rationale.
Yeah.
And I've always thought that it's much more important to know what you're trying to do and why than it is exactly how you achieve it. And so in that sense, I think up till now, a lot of the architectural studies have been flawed because they basically assume that we're going to go and here's how to do it. And they get wrapped around the details of how, you know, with this rocket engine, it's this lander system, it's this launch vehicle. And I think it's much more important to know what your mission is. What are you trying to achieve? What's your envisioned endpoint? And the paper that Tony and I wrote, and that's been 2.5 years ago now, when we wrote that back in 2010, we were interested in the first thing in the paper is the why. Why are we going to the moon? What do we hope to achieve? And what we hope to achieve is to use lunar water to actually create a permanent spacefaring system in cislunar. That's our mission, and that was our mission statement. And then everything else becomes actually secondary. I mean, how you do it is really determined by what kind of time frame are you looking at and what resources do you have. So, in fact, this whole idea about NASA doesn't have enough money, it's the wrong argument. The question is, what should NASA be doing? Why is NASA doing what it's doing? And then worry about how to do it, and the amount of resources you have will sort of dictate the schedule.
Absolutely. I always say that the biggest problems are our leadership and understanding why we're doing it, not the technology or the money.
And, you know, that was what was really frustrating back in the early days of the vision when it seemed that the first couple of years after it was announced in 2005, 2006, that time frame, there was a lot of floundering at NASA. And I remember workshops where they were saying, well, why are we going to the moon? And I, I kept getting up at each one of those missions. And I said, did nobody read the speech that President Bush gave? Did nobody read the document that came out at the time the vision was announced? Your mission is in there. The mission was to go to the moon with the goal of working and staying there for increasingly longer periods of time, with the object of creating new space flight capability. That was the mission. That was stated in the speech. It was stated in the documents. And NASA never got that, or rather, they refused to accept it. I don't know which was true. They were so focused on the Mars part of the vision that they didn't know why they were going to the moon. So it quickly became, we're going to the moon to touch the surface, and then we're going to dash off to Mars. So that's the origin of the touch and go concept. And they were more interested in developing an exit strategy for the moon than they were in developing an arrival strategy. So consequently, it's no wonder that things got screwed up, because no one could state in one sentence what their mission was.
You have another caller on hold. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Hi, David. It's Mike Listener.
Hi, Mike. Good to talk to you.
Likewise. Just a couple comments. And, you know, this is what we celebrated yesterday, the 44th anniversary of going of Apollo 11 landing on the moon.
Yesterday.
And one of the things I noticed always when this time of year rolls around, people are just, you know, there's a lot of news stories, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of chest thumping and stuff. And it really reminds me a lot of what happened to the Soviet Union when we finally landed on the moon, where their technology really couldn't match up to theirs. They spent more time reliving past glories and building monuments to past glories than they did about moving forward their space program and their production. And really, that's where we kind of ended up right now. We're more about chest thumping and honoring the men who actually landed on the moon and those who helped get in there. But we're chest thumping instead of really moving forward. Two, and this was brought up earlier when discussing about James Webb. Right now, you know, there is so much. There is more focus on who to place the blame in case it fails, instead of accepting the fact that there might be failures, and just and accepting that risk and going ahead anyways. Now, I know we've been through the whole risk averse discussion, the environment risk aversion in NASA out of the program and stuff like that. But it's really saddening, you know, that, you know, where the first concern is, you know, well, if this fails, who's going to get blamed, or who has it's going to be on the chopping block? I mean, James Webb, it's a whole other story. I have my own opinions on it, which I won't go into here. But, you know, but working from the past glory mentality plus the who's going to get blamed mentality, how do you expect a space program, a government space program, to move forward when they're really sitting under those two clouds?
Paul?
I certainly agree that there is a tendency to fetishize Apollo as the ultimate achievement. In a way, you know, it's sort of like the people that lived in the latter days of Rome. They dreamt about the Augustan age as the golden age, and so that seems to be the tendency today in space. And in part, that tendency has come about because a stasis has set in, where we're not really doing anything, and we're seen not to be doing anything. And that feeds on itself, all right? If you're not doing anything, and yet you keep saying all these great things you're going to do, people start to lose interest. People stop paying attention to you. And so effectively, you're right to identify that as a problem. We should be doing stuff and not talking about it. Part of the problem is that NASA has become very process-oriented. It's much more important for them to follow a process than it is to make a product. And it wasn't that way in the early days. There was an imperative to do stuff and for accomplishment, and that was not really an option for them to talk too much about process. They invented the process as they went along. As far as Webb goes, I agree. I didn't suggest I wanted to see it junked. I mean, we spent $10 billion on it. The damn thing ought to get launched, and hopefully it'll work. I'm just saying that the person who called in was concerned about it, and my point was that, well, he's right to be concerned, because it's a complicated machine, and if it gets out there and it doesn't deploy properly, there's no way to fix it. So it is something to worry about. And Curiosity rover was something to worry about, because the way it was delivered to the surface had a lot of people very nervous.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess my my statement that, you know, NASA is really risk averse is kind of too general a statement, because there are some risks that they will take, that are agreed they will take, but still there's always, you know, there's always the other cloud that says who's going to get blamed if it fails, and that's always that cloud sitting up ahead. I mean, just too political. I mean, it just goes back, you know, to it's not a very proactive philosophy when, you know, you have to worry about getting blamed for something if it goes wrong because it's too risky, versus, hey, saying, you know, if this is a very, very risky endeavor, it could very well fail, but you know what, we got to learn from the lessons and move on. I guess my only other comment is basically the new space community and NASA. I hear a lot of people and frequently argue with a lot of people about the role of NASA, and a lot of the people, the purists in the new space community, say, well, we got to secure NASA, it's all going to be commercial space. I disagree. I think both the commercial sector, and I'll use that term lightly, considering, you know, the earlier discussion about, you know, SpaceX and how it's funded, and NASA can learn a lot from each other. I mean, and I really see that as a partnership moving forward, as really not they're partners more than competitors, and really I don't think one can really do it without the other. That's just my opinion, but I see that as an integral part of our space policy going forward.
Yeah, that you're probably right, and certainly it's something that that we hope succeeds, because if it doesn't, then we're really in serious trouble.
Well, and that goes back to my other position. You know, like commercial space hasn't really proven itself succinctly enough where you can say, well, we don't need NASA, because you may need, you know, if for some reason it shouldn't be profitable and it should fail, you're going to need NASA even more to continue your space program.
Yeah, I think they have sort of different purposes. NASA should be, I would think, a more of a cutting edge demonstrator of ideas and concepts, technical concepts in space. Whereas I would think commercial operators would provide a service of something that's well established, like orbital flight, for instance. So mm-hmm. So they sort of have different spheres of imperium, if you will. And they do overlap, and yes, it is possible for each to learn from the other. I just think that commercial is in a much more primitive state of development these days than a lot of people think.
Well, I tend to agree with that. I frequently debate with people who don't believe that. But
oh, I do too, and that's fun, isn't it?
Well, sometimes it is.
You got to be.
Sometimes it is. Sometimes it can get downright frustrating, but. But I'm sure we've all had those experiences.
What else, Michael?
That's it for today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tim is in St. Louis. And listeners, I guess there's still time for another call or so if you want to do it, 866-687-7223. Paul, would you please share your innermost thoughts? I swear that's what the guy says. On the Dennis Tito Inspiration Mars mission, as well as the Dutch Mars Direct mission for the one-way habitats.
My innermost thoughts.
Yeah, what do you really think about him? I guess that's what he means.
Is that what he means?
I'm interpreting. I don't know what he means, but
I think Dennis Tito's idea is heartfelt. I mean, I think he's trying to do something that he thinks will move the ball down the field. I am skeptical as to whether it really will or not. I mean, I sure as hell would not want to spend a year in a tin can for a 20-minute encounter with Mars, on the night side, no less.
Well, wouldn't it matter as who you were spending it with?
No. I don't want to spend a year in a tin can with anybody. but I mean, more than that, I mean, what is it really going to accomplish? We already know we can send spacecraft to Mars. I mean, it might be something to send one there and recover it. I mean, that hasn't been done. But again, you're buying into the stunt mentality. I guess that's my biggest objection to it. As far as the one-way ticket Dutch guys, I think that's just loony.
you're not ready to go live on Mars and never come back?
No. And you know, who would want to?
Well, they got 80,000 applicants in 2 weeks.
Yeah, well, you know, people want to do all kinds of dumb stuff. It doesn't mean that they're sane, and it doesn't mean that everyone should want to do that either. The idea of going somewhere and staying there, you know, the fact is you'd probably die. you know, it, one system failure and you would die, and that would be the end of it, and who would remember you?
There might be a Wikipedia page about the book.
Yeah, Darwin Award, maybe.
Speaking of dying, do you think the crew that does the Inspiration Mars mission can survive it?
Probably, if with a little bit of luck. And I say that make no mistake, it would be a hell of a risk to take to go on a year long trip, totally with and they're going to worry about solar flares. I know they will, and they'll say, well, we're protected. The chances are that they will get a fairly good radiation dose, and it may well be fatal. On the other hand, it's just on the ragged edge of what someone might survive. So I don't want to say they would definitely die. I would say that they would have a high risk of dying, and it would not be something I would want to risk my life on. But they just might pull it off.
I've had people on who say even if they pulled it off, the science learned from such a mission would be marginal. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that.
That kind of surprised me initially, but when they explained it to me, I sort of came into a line of thinking that.
I don't think there's any real science value to that. I think it's more of a gee whiz. You know, hey, I went to Mars. You know, when you go to cocktail parties, you can introduce yourself that way.
Couple more emails. Can you stick around?
Yeah.
Okay. So Charles Pooley sent in a comment more than a question. He says, I live in Las Vegas, and I would not bet a nickel on lassoing an asteroid. Okay.
Well, I'd say the man knows how to keep his money safe.
Charles would not bet a nickel that the sun is going to rise in the morning, so everything in its perspective, okay? Okay, Bill Melberg has a very interesting email. He also emailed it directly to you as well. David and Paul, have we lost our curiosity, and I don't think he means what's roving around on Mars right now.
Right.
It seems to me that most people today don't ask themselves what's out there. Thus, they have no interest in further exploring the moon. Last night, I spent several hours with an 11-year-old aspiring astronaut, the daughter of a good friend. She's a gifted kid, and her interest and curiosity and enthusiasm were infectious, but I don't think she's typical. And with the taxpayer supporting space exploration program, there's a problem, Bill.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. His experience mimics a lot of mine. I deal with a lot of students. I speak to students at the LPI. I'm an advisor of the summer intern program, which are undergraduates, and I deal with kids and young people who are extremely interested in space and enthusiastic about it and excited about it. And they always ask me that. I said, well, why aren't we doing anything? Why aren't we going there? And I give them the talk. I say, well, here's why we did this, and here's why we're not doing it now, and here's the problem before you. I think that there is a problem with society in general. That there seems to be a in part it's the success of computer generated images. Hollywood has made space so realistic and so visually exciting that the real space, which is actually kind of a mundane kind of place, you don't have noises in it, and you don't have giant planets whizzing by and galaxies with big spiral whirlpools like you see in the Hubble images, and it's basically black, and you have sunlight, and it's cold, and you kind of hang there. So interplanetary flight is astonishingly boring compared to, say, the latest edition of Star Wars. And so people have a different expectation of space flight. And when we were growing up, and Bill knows this as well because he and I have talked about it on numerous occasions, you know, we lived, eat, and breathe this stuff. I mean, we kept scrapbooks. We wrote to NASA for pictures and books. We just loved the stuff. We couldn't get enough of it. In part, that was because we had no other source of it. You know, nowadays you can get on the internet and find anything you want for virtually any interest. So there is a dulling of the senses, and I think that dulling of the senses has actually impaired our ability to feel excitement and curiosity, as he puts it.
Well, I think all the gadgets that we have and all the options that we have for self-entertainment have absolutely contributed to the decline of our culture and our civilization. I have no doubt about that. We are so easily pacified with crap and diverted, and our minds taken up with things that are really unimportant, like Facebook postings or tweets or whatever.
You realize, of course, David, that now you and Bill and I have officially reached the status of old fogeydom.
Yeah, we're geezers. There's no doubt. And I got a half a dozen other people that are like that, too. But you're right. I mean, I was born in 46, so, you know, we had three television networks, and I remember Frank Reynolds and the guys in the space program. They had all the model rockets on their desk, right? And they'd actually show us the model rocket, because they didn't have any gadgetry and special effects and image, you know, or anything like that. And they'd hold them up, and then on the one hand is the moon in the left hand, and the rocket's coming over on the right.
Yeah,
and,
I remember.
You know, they did things like that. And
we had Mr. Wizard demonstrating science.
And
all that stuff was great, and we grew up with that, and that was exciting to us, and we had curiosity. But, you know, now your sense of discovery is dulled because you're assaulted. Your senses are assaulted 24/7 by media,
and
it's on television, whether it's on the internet, whether it's on your smartphone, it's constant.
Absolutely. I was at a restaurant last night with friends, and everybody who came to the table, the waiters and everybody, and probably it was the wrong crowd to ask, what's so special about today from 44 years ago? So it was a zero. It was a perfect zero score. Nobody knows that we landed on the moon with Apollo 44 years ago yesterday. And the people that I was with had forgotten it. They're my age. Wasn't even in their consciousness. They had forgotten it. And people were kind of looking our way from other tables. And I would say, do you guys know what happened 44 years ago today? Zero. Totally zero. And if they had kids with them that were, you know, of a reasonable age, did you study anything in school about this day in history? Zero.
You know, there's an interesting point here, and this is something that we tend to look at with rose-colored glasses in retrospect. You know, because we lived through Apollo, and we were so excited by it, and it changed our lives in a profound way, we think that happened to everyone at that time. And yet, you know, there's a very interesting paper by Roger Launius about 10 years ago, where he actually looked at opinion polls around the time of Apollo and before and then after. And the support for the moon landings was astonishingly low, and always was. And people in retrospect say, yeah, I guess it was a good idea, I'm glad we went. But even at the time it was done, there were people that were against it. People were dead set against it. I remember protest marches against, you know, spending money on going to the moon. It was a dumb idea. And so a lot of what we sense as having lost, we never really had to begin with. Apollo came about because of a very interesting and unique set of historical circumstances, and it will not be repeated. So the question before us is, for those of us who believe in spaceflight, how can we achieve a capability like that without the requirement of getting people frothing at the mouth for some space goal? Because that's what NASA thinks. See, NASA thinks all we have to do is get people excited about something, and that's why they're so hot on man Mars and finding life, because they think that's so exciting. How can you not care about that? And yet go out and ask the average guy on the street if he cares about it. He doesn't care about it.
He doesn't care about it one bit.
And so I think they're pursuing and you cannot persuade them of this obsession. They have believed this for 45 years. They will believe it for another 45 years. They think all we have to do is figure out the right goal and the right way to present it, and we'll be showered with money and love. And they'll never get the love, and I very much doubt that they're going to get much money either.
Now, space is opening my car door when I lock it out, and GPS to find directions.
But nobody credits space with that.
No,
so that's just a box that does magic.
Bill sent us an additional email. Allie I guess that's the young lady that he was with, had a night sky app on her iPad last night that was fantastic. I wish I had it as a kid. Heck, Bill, come on, they didn't even know what an iPad was when they were
Well, no, we saw it in 2001. The crew of the Discovery had them when they were eating their dinner. They had two iPads there. They were watching their interview on television.
I wish I had it as a kid. You just hold the iPad up to the sky, and it shows you exactly what you can see in the part of the sky, planets, nebulas, stars, clusters, etc. Fantastic. It also helps her decide where to point her telescope. By the way, she doesn't do Facebook. Good for that, Bill. I wish you had the name of that app because it might be good for the iPhone as well. So, Bill, if you can get the name of that app, I will announce it on the next Space Show program because there might be a lot of people who would be interested in it. Boy, that shows how our world has changed.
Yeah, it does. But, you know, when I didn't have an iPad or, and that great piece of software, but I had my little torn out of the pages of Sky and Telescope sky map that I could take outside and try to match up with what I was seeing.
Yeah, I had a Cub Scout telescope. Remember those? concluding comments, where you would like to leave us today or take us somewhere else as we wind down the program?
No, I don't have any profound thoughts. I've enjoyed our discussion as usual. I hope it wasn't too much of a downer. I do think there is reason for hope. And the reason for hope is that some people are concerned about the state of the space program. They are aware that there is a logical path forward, and they want to see it implemented, and we're working to do that. I don't know if we'll succeed or not, but I know that it's not all bad news. The first step in solving a problem is recognizing you have one. So in that sense, I think all is not lost.
Do you think space advocacy is useful and constructive and helpful?
Some of it is, and some of it isn't. But I do know that if there's no space advocacy, I think that's bad, because that means that sends a message to lawmakers that no one cares about this, and that's begging for cancel. That's a program begging for cancellation. So if you believe in the space program and you have definite serious ideas on how it should proceed, I think you should let your congressman know. That's the only way they have to gauge what public reaction is.
You have another 11th hour question. Ben from Oakland, California, just across from where I am. Is there a way to subscribe to alerts from your website or blog so we know when your next article is published?
Actually, there is. On my blog, if you go to my website homepage and then go to the blog,
right.
And it's linked at the very top of the page, you can. There's a thing on the right-hand column that allows you to put your email in, and you'll be notified when I put a new post up.
Okay. So, people, I suggest you do that. Do you have another one in mind that you're working on or that you're going to work on?
I have a couple of ideas I'm mulling around, but I haven't actually written anything yet. But I am thinking over a couple topics.
Okay. Until the next time, do you have another plan to go before Congress, or have they had enough of you?
Well, of course, you never know. When you get the summons, you go. But I haven't heard from them since the last one. I'm assuming that I won't go for a while yet.
Well,
but you never know.
At least you haven't been summoned before the NSA or something for all that you do. So you're only going up to testify before Congress.
That I know of.
Well, you would know if they'd called you up there, right?
Unless yeah, I will. Who
they,
knows?
Maybe they do things like they do in Italy in absentia, so I don't know. Listen, it's been great and very informative, and I look forward until the next time that you can come on the show and share some more of your forward thinking and problem solving with us.
Thank you, David. I've enjoyed it as always.
Okay, and that's it for today. Listeners, look at the newsletters for the week's programming coming up. I will upload the website newsletter probably within half an hour, and we have a full week of programming. But one thing I want to call to your attention is a technical capability assessment that will rock your mind, and you may love it or you may hate it. But Dr. Dennis Bushnell of NASA Langley, their chief science officer, has written this. I got a hold of it, and I got Dennis to come back on the air to talk about it. And in the newsletters, I tell you how to go find this assessment. And Boy, is he reality-based, and I think you will really appreciate it, and you'll probably want to listen to Dennis on Tuesday night on The Space Show. Thank you all very much, and we'll see you tomorrow with Rich Godwin on his new commercial space company and what they're doing, and that's tomorrow, 2 p.m. Everybody have a good week. It's the New Space Conference for those of you going toward the end of the week. I will be there, not on Friday, No Space Show on Friday, but then I am back again on Sunday, and Eric Seedhouse will be with us to talk about his new book about SpaceX and the commercial space companies. Thank you all. Goodbye from Dr. Spoutis and The Space Show.